All right.
So I think we spent the second half of the last lecture with me talking around this material, but never actually getting started on the lecture itself. But we're at a kind of a point in the course where I want to get across, through Jonas, the significance of Darwin's theory of evolution on our thinking now, and how it isn't just a scientific theory that is of interest to biologists, but that it's fundamentally informed our understanding of our being here, of what it is to be alive, to be here on Earth. Maria's questions often reflect on them. I can't help on it later, you know, as saying, oh, well, I accept, I think there's nothing terrible about the theory of evolution. You know, I was saying that if you fully accept it, it's an incredibly bleak and meaningless view of what it is to be alive here. I accept, actually, that I don't think people who fully accept the theory of evolution, I guess I have to be psychological about this, they accept it intellectually. But I don't want to create the impression that there's a group of people here who fully embrace the theory of evolution with their whole being. There's a kind of a psychological thing here. I feel a bit Jungian about it. You accept it intellectually, but there's still another part of your being that doesn't accept it at all. That just carries on living ordinary life, that remains in some way unaffected by it. And in a way, what we're doing in this course is we're excavating this intellectual understanding, bringing it to light, bringing it to the light of consciousness. Because you'd think, because somebody accepts it intellectually, that's the same as bringing it to the light of consciousness. But accepting something intellectually is stage one of it, really, is just believing it. And there's a certain set of beliefs that go along with the theory of evolution. And why are they important? When most of the people that you might interview on the street would probably not be able to enunciate what the theory of evolution is with any great detail. It hovers in the background, and it has, in some sense, destroyed a former way of understanding life. That destruction has occurred in our culture. If I could put it more simplistically, the sort of sense I have of this is that it's a bit like there's always two sides to the question. What was previously destroyed, which was an Aristotelian view of the world, was half true. This is generally what happens. The scientific revolution saw the half that didn't work. It was false, if you like, in that worldview, and threw the entirety out and embraced another view that was a reaction against that, that again is half true and half false. It's because I've been studying Jung that I'm beginning to see this as a sort of a dialectic here, and the human race seems to embrace one way of understanding things, and then as soon as it starts to see that there are cracks in it and things that it can't explain and it doesn't work, the whole thing is just rejected. You know, we are very I think there's a certain level of thinking here which is just a kind of a yes-no plus-minus binary way of thinking that does this, that is always just lurching from one half true position to another, and never really reaching a higher level or understanding of what both sides. I mean, this is Hegelian. If you know your Hegel, you've got your thesis and your antithesis, and then a synthesis should emerge from that that isn't one or the other, but is transcendent of it. And in a way, that's the looking at evolution here is partly an attempt to get to that a better or a synthesized understanding of what evolution is, that isn't just a materialistic science understanding of it, and isn't going back to Aristotle. I think there's a unity there, a synthesis that Hans Jonas was one of the first people, Heidegger too, to reach towards, and it's still present as a potentiality in modern biology, and that's why I was talking to Maria about the talk that she put up. I forget the guy's name. But it was a good expression that there's questions being asked in the philosophy of biology. He wasn't quite sure if the biologists are asking the questions, but certainly in the philosophy of biology, there's an attempt to reach towards a better, more unified understanding of life, and the same thing's happening in sort of mainstream philosophy of mind. In terms of trying to understand consciousness, something there are good things occurring, if you like, in terms of trying to get beyond this materialistic position that our culture has become entrenched in. But we still are entrenched in it, in the sense that it's the background understanding that we still live in, like the medievals lived in an Aristotelian Christian understanding. So the fact that these ideas are floating around doesn't mean that our culture's changed. It's but the potentiality is there. Of course, if we look into history, I'm about to say the strong likelihood is we're going to lurch to some other anti-position to where we are now, that'll have its own crisis. Probably in another. Well, things are speeding up so much.
Do you think that this context of materialistic science includes the Arab world?
Well, I was funnily. It's funny you should mention that. Well, I almost feel like turning the tape off because it's such a sensitive issue. But just what I was reflecting on. I'll never be able to go to the United States again.
In the Arab world, there's like a heavy criticism of the West.
Yes.
That the West is evil. And
yes. Yeah. I was looking into this. It's the Twin Towers. You know, the jets going in the Twin Towers. I found that deeply symbolic. I think we all did, right? But my sense was of it was that the Western culture, with its scientific materialism, and it doesn't say it's scientific materialism, it says it's all about democracy and freedom and capitalism. Yeah. But behind that, I see essentially is scientific materialism, with its absolute self-certainty of its own correctness. That what the world needs now, it's not love's, it's not love, sweet love, it's democracy and capitalism. And the utter self-certainty of that, which, as a what democracy and capitalism does is, it is because of the scientific materialism behind it, it desacralizes the world. It sucks out the sacredness, the sense that of the sacred out of the world, and just leaves behind dead matter. And I have a sense that Islam, insofar as it's still a living religion, has a sense of the sacred. You know, there was one of the first things that really bit here was the satanic verses, wasn't it? Salman Rushdie's book, and then You know, there basically is in Iran, they're issuing that, what was it? They were going to kill him anyway.
A fatwa.
That's a kind of a classic example, isn't it, of something that we in the West consider utterly irrational and completely against our principles of freedom of speech and et cetera, without any real understanding that the Satanic Verses refers to the Quran, right, which is a sacred book, which is held sacred. And what that means to us as a culture, we think it's all just fairy stories, really, don't we? And there's nothing sacred for us. The Quran's not sacred. I mean, Jesus is we've still got a little bit sensitive about Jesus, but not the basic. I've seen it in my own lifetime, the kind of the sense of the sacred in the Christian church, in the bigger culture, it's become fair game. The Life of Brian, that movie, was a big turning point in that. You mustn't upset, you know, or say anything bad about Christianity and about Jesus. And The Life of Brian really wiped that away, and everything's been fair game, large. But do you see, we live in a totally... To someone who has faith and holds certain things ultimately sacred, that, you know, having a sense that there's a world beyond this world. I'm not saying, but that the utter self certainty of the West, and its complete adherence to rationality. So there's no, you can't penetrate it. It's impenetrable. The scientific materialistic rationality of our Western culture has got a certain utter certainty about it, an impenetrability. That I just saw those jets going in the Twin Towers is about the only statement you can make to unsettle that self certainty. There would be no rational argument, but that made the point. It didn't make the point rationally. It made the point viscerally. And I found it's like the Titanic going down. It's just such a symbol. Because they're the trade towers, right? They're the pillars of capitalism. Down they came. At the time, I think we all maybe felt that. I felt it. It's like the Titanic, something like the First World War's coming. You know, it's the end of this world now, isn't this? It's a presage of the end of this world order that we're living in. It's still too early to say, isn't it? But it was quite an extraordinary event that's really determined the times for us since then. It's strange, isn't it? Yes.
On that day, I came into work and it was on the telly, you know, I was in charge of an oncology unit, and I always remember the consultant that I used to do the rounds with first thing in the morning, saying it just takes a long time for the Roman Empire, it took a long time for the Roman Empire to fall, and he's a very rational man, so he's still teaching this.
Because
I was like, oh, you know, the end of the world, you know, it's the end of this all.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Rome was sacked multiple times, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
So we're still.
Yes. But we digress, because that I was reflecting on that because if I ever get through the lecture, in a way I'd like to explain how nature has become. And the Darwin's theory of evolution is a deep aspect of how nature has become desacralized, although it was happening before that. You know, nothing happens in just, you know, in like that in a switch. And the fact that our self-certainty and the self-certainty of Western science about anyone who dares question evolution you're basically immediately cast into a kind of a primitive, superstitious, brainwashed believer, if you dare to question evolution. And to a certain extent, that picture of many of the more extreme ends of people who are fighting against evolution, you know, in the Midwest, in the USA, there's some truth in that too. It's not coming from a well argued or intellectual place. But I guess had that sense from Islam and from that there are deeper things at work in the psyche that in some sense recognise something that maybe the ecology movement is more consciously recognising, that there's something wrong with our attitude towards the earth, deeply wrong. And that's part of why we have to look into evolution, because the theory of evolution is one of the... at the same time, I feel like we have to recognise it's one of the extraordinary intellectual advances that the human race has achieved. It's not just rubbish, right? You can't toss it out. You can't toss the fossil record out. You can't. It's an amazing story, to get the sense of the amazing story, you need to go to David Attenborough, right? He's like the elder of our community, who in some sense embodies an acceptance of the theory of evolution, but at the same time with a deep reverence of nature. Yes, but he doesn't have, I guess, he lacks a clear critique. He's still part of the prevailing mindset that thinks that the reason that we're destroying the planet is that we're not rational enough. Yeah, and I guess this in this course when we're looking at theory of evolution, I'm saying it's not. Yes.
Big paper for me next week.
Yeah.
Can you use the IT suite?
Yeah, yeah. It's all stuffed, is it? To Gunnell's.
Well, yeah, everyone's arguing over the room.
Are they? Yeah. So, where are we? What was I just saying?
Attenborough.
Oh yes, and the idea that we're not rational enough. That's really what David Attenborough's argument is. Can you see what's happening? It's irrational what we're doing to the earth. So he still, in some sense, thinks that we can fix what we're doing within the framework of the way that we're living, without fundamentally having to reconstruct the framework in which we're living. And I guess if I've got another message from this course is that we need to look really in what's behind our rationality, and our science at a deeper level. So I feel like I often have to go. This is like largely a motivational. Speech. It's a motivational speech before we get into the details of Hans Jonas. Because Jonas isn't saying this, right? He's not saying what I'm saying, how does it connect to everything else, because he's just writing an essay, right? We're trying to make a brief point, but the essay I'm trying to say it's very significant how we understand the theory of evolution. And Hans Jonas is comes from this phenomenological tradition, which I think has a much better insight into things than our own mainstream analytic philosophy does. And the only other thing I'd like to mention is if anyone's watched the talk that Maria put up on the website. And if you haven't, you might want to, because it's quite interesting. It gives you an idea, a glimpse into how sort of more mainstream academics are thinking about. He was talking about the philosophy of biology in this talk. It's in, it's on the chat. Is it the chat part of the of the forum. I always like to say, well, the thing that struck me about that talk was A, yeah, he's still working within that rational framework, and B, there's a current critique now against what's called mechanistic science, as if we're going to get a new science that isn't mechanistic anymore. And in that talk, you'll if you listen carefully, you'll get he's not explaining exactly what he means by mechanism, but he's got a very simplistic idea of what a mechanism is. Something like a car or a steam engine, where you've got components that fit together, and he's saying that that kind of mechanistic understanding doesn't fit life, doesn't describe a living cell. We'll be dealing with this more in this course, but he's because I'm a computer scientist, so I have a specialism in understanding what computing is, which I think he lacked. You know, this is the terrible thing. You know, we've all got our little specialisms, and he flagged his own. He didn't understand in that talk that that the idea of what a machine is became completely transformed with the advent of the computer, because the computer is not like a steam engine. It can be any machine you like. You know, because you can program it, and so our idea of what a machine is became so immensely expanded with the invention, or this almost, I like to say, discovery of the computer, particularly by Alan Turing. And I may have to, and I know you're going to maybe find this a bit difficult. I may have to explain to you what computing means at a certain point, because we really get to the heart, the dark heart of mechanism, until you understand what, and maybe you do already, don't want to assume that you don't, till you get to what a computer is. Because for me, I think the computer is like the thing that it is. Was with the germ of it, the little seed was right there in the scientific revolution. It was going to come. The computer is one of the ultimate expressions of this kind of rationalistic mathematical understanding of life, the universe, and everything. It ends up with the computer, and it ends up with the kind of with the very question that people are seriously asking now, which is that are computers, artificially intelligent computers, going to end up running the world? I mean, slowly they're going to take over menial intellectual tasks, but already they're likely to be able to handle law cases, driving cars. Maybe running small government departments. It's going to spread out to the point where we're going to be unable to distinguish ourselves intellectually from computers. This is all, I'm just expanding on this. What is a machine? Well, a computer is a machine. To say that a cell is not mechanical, would one way to one question you could ask is, if it's not mechanical, does that mean that you couldn't simulate the behaviour of a cell in a computer? Mm. And if you can simulate the behaviour of the cell in a computer and a computer's a machine, then in what way is a cell not a machine? The gist of that being that a cell within that materialistic scientific view really is just a certain kind of very complex machine, still a machine, because within that view everything is a machine. The universe is a machine and everything in it is a machine. What does that mean? It means that everything is determined by law, inviolable law. That's all it means to be a machine. If you're completely determined by inviolable law, that's what it means to be a machine.
Did you see any of Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror series? That's all about the kind of, you know, he extends some of the, you know, sci-fi scenarios of computers becoming more powerful and things like that. And then he projects into the near future, and then these his little very, very dark plays about what might happen.
Yes.
And that's a bit quite chilling.
Yes.
See, John, you
seen? No, I haven't. I think I should.
I'll put one on the internet.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Some quite beautiful as well.
Oh, they are, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not all just chilling. There's a lot more episodes that show light side.
Did you see the one about the bees? It's about a future situation where real bees have died out, ecological disaster, no bees, and so the government has created little nano computer drones.
Nano bees. Yes.
And they whiz around quite happily, sort of pollinating, and everything's fine. But what people don't realise is that the government have put facial recognition abilities into these bees. So when somebody hacks into the program and the bees start to kill people, you know, and it ends up with 300,000 people die as a result of this, you know, you can see a scenario where somehow things have gone horribly wrong as a result of what appeared on the surface to be quite a benign life-saving.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there's a. One of the things that I've kind of concluded from my own looking at artificial intelligence, one of the kind of the sort of, there's something terrible here, that again it comes out of our scientific rationalism. Is that we, at a certain level in our scientific rationalism, we already understand ourselves to be a sort of a machine, very sophisticated, complex machine. So we've already set up the scenario with Descartes, you know, 400 years ago, which is arriving now in the future for us, where we aren't going to be able to distinguish ourselves from the machines that we're building, not because there isn't a difference, but because we already understand ourselves to be machines within us. And when I say we, I mean the people who are developing the technology already think of human beings as a form of machine. So we've got this deep question. It's supposed to be a deep question. How are we going to tell ourselves apart? Are we different? And the conclusion, it's not as if it's a real live question, because you've, in the background, you've already assumed a position where you're not going to be able to distinguish yourself from machines. So you get already discussions, like semi-sci-fi discussions, about whether artificial intelligence should have the vote.
Should they be
granted, human rights?
Would they have voted for Brexit?
Yeah.
We ask.
Is it moral to switch them off? Questions that at a certain level, you see at a certain level, and as I was saying earlier, that there's another half of us that just see that's mad, right? It's not as if we don't have the other half that sees there's a certain. But if you follow the rational arguments, what's your response? What's your response to the people who are thinking this way? I'm not. This is a rhetorical. It's a rhetorical question.
How long have you
been? Yes. So that's back up and see, well, how did we end up with such a view? I think it began with the scientific revolution and with Galileo and Newton and with this idea that we can study the material aspect of nature. And it was understood at the beginning to be the material aspect. It wasn't understood to be all and everything, but the material aspect. And, because if we follow Descartes sort of formalized it, that there's a material nature that's measurable, and then there's an immaterial nature, which is your consciousness. Not that they were using the word consciousness. We've got these two realms, and in the material realm, everything is determined by these laws. In a way, you could say that was a hypothesis. But if you look at the progress of science, and we were talking about this previously, the progress of science just says, okay, it's a hypothesis, but it's one that we keep on confirming. Yes, we've looked at nature now in this mathematical materialistic way for hundreds of years, and we don't turn up anything that goes against the laws of physics. Remember, we were discussing the paranormal. Part of that is because science only recognizes what is repeatable and reliable. So, in a way, the way that science has a kind of a view of what is real that's already in the background to begin with. What is real is what's material, and what's real within the material is what can be reliably measured, which means measured over and over and over and over. If you can measure something over and over and over and over, then it's real. If something happens completely inexplicably, apparently, looks like a miracle, looks like some sort of psychic event, paranormal event, it's either A, imagined, a kind of a hallucination, or B, just an extraordinary coincidence. So that's in that sort of framework that deals with anything that doesn't adhere to that to the law is dealt with in those two ways. And the extraordinary coincidence is saying, yeah, that does adhere to the law. It's just something extraordinarily unlikely happened there. But if we were able to trace it down, it would be adhering to the laws of physics. And the other stuff that can't be explained in that way, you had just all had a group hallucination or something like that. And so it was all just going on in your brains, which in a way itself would have been a result of some previous suggestion that would be a... Everything within that materialistic science view in advance is going to be set into that framework. And then the framework it goes on and on, confirming itself. Do you see? Because it's a kind of a game where it does confirm itself. Although... we have to say that the universe is set up in a very interesting way, in that something like material science never does actually bump into God. Right? This is one of the things that I think in materialistic science people think something along these lines. Well, if there were a God, like is envisaged in many religions, then why doesn't he or she or whatever just do the Jesus thing, right? Just come along and say, well, here's a miracle. Yeah? Here I am. You know, here I am on national television. I'm God, right? Do you see this skyscraper here in the middle of London? Up it goes. I'm God. Got it? Right? That... Do you see? It's not, that doesn't happen. Yeah, we certainly do. We live in a kind of a universe where that doesn't happen, right? The mirror, it's not just that our materialistic science has made everything lawful. It really is lawful in that way, and that's of interest in itself, right? I'm partly being critical of science, but at the same time, the lawfulness of the behaviour of events here is extraordinary. That's been a discovery, right, of science. And the depth to which science has been able to follow that lawfulness, you know, right through the theory that there are molecules, to the theory that there are atoms, to the theory that there are subatomic particles, right down to the quantum level. That's not all fiction. There's layers and layers and layers of lawfulness that show up to this kind of investigation, and that's not fiction, right? The thing is, in a way, we have to, if we're going to be intelligent, we've got to hold all of that in mind. We're not living in a place where miracles are occurring on a daily basis, or where there's some supernatural power that's been able to demonstrate to everybody that it exists in any kind of
just as Hume that wrote on miracles, and Hume, David Hume,
yes,
philosopher.
Yes,
I think this kind of, would you say that this general entering into our culture about disbelieving in miracles kind of started there when he wrote on miracles, and he sort of said there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that these things happen? And
well, I think it was already presaged in the scientific revolution,
right,
and also in the or maybe even in Protestantism. Do you know how Christianity itself, in rejecting Catholicism, was starting to reject a kind of a very psychic, symbolic kind of visionary kind of Christianity, for one that was all about being rational and reading the Bible and accepting the word of God, and not accepting the priest's view of things and all of this mumbo jumbo in Latin. That was the beginning, even before the scientific revolution, of a movement in humanity to take its immediate sensory experience very seriously. Or more seriously.
Oh, and how Protestantism lends itself very well to capitalism.
Yes, yeah, yeah. The sort of, because this didn't come out of nowhere. Mm. The there are roots that Hans Jonas wants to draw as well, in that Christianity was already sort of setting the ground for this kind of view of the world that we've inherited, and it's still there. You know, I've been saying it's like archaeology. We've got the layers, and in Western capitalism, it was definitely a Protestant layer behind the science, and under the Protestant layer is the Catholic layer, you know, the Holy Roman Empire, and under that there's the paganism of Rome, and then the Greeks. You know, this is just Western culture, you know. We're excavating Western culture, because Western culture is becoming the global culture, you know. So in a way you have to deconstruct that culture. Unless it's unproblematic, but I think we would agree that it's problematic. So the point of this slide is just that there was a tremendous reversal in understanding. A tremendous reversal with the scientific revolution. Previously, it seemed absolutely obvious that the universe had to have been created by a higher intelligence. That nothing comes from nothing. If there has to be a reason for something to be the way it is, and if we look at the universe, there has to be a reason for the universe to be the way it is. There has to be a reason for there to be human beings. There has to be a reason for there to be plants, for there to be animals. And if we look into it with our kind of naturalistic reasoning, we would say, well, the reason we can see in our own culture for there being buildings and tools and books and music, the reason is us, yes? And we are the higher cause of all of our cultural artifacts. We're as a, what a work of perfection is man. Wasn't that Hamlet, somewhere in Hamlet? We are the extraordinary cause of our culture, and by analogy almost, even disregarding the psychic dimension of religion, just by rational analogy, you would say, so in order, we've created all of this, who created us? Who created nature? Who created the sun and the earth? There has to be a higher intelligence and everything that's an effect is the effect of a cause that is greater than what it causes. And this, for Descartes as well, was something that he understood. If you read him, this is where you start to feel dodgy about Descartes. He sees that by the light of reason, by the light of his natural intelligence, he says. It just has to be the case. He thought that there were certain innate ideas that we could just see the truth of in themselves. And this was one of them, that there had to be a higher cause for any kind of effect. But when you look into Newton and science, materialistic science, the whole thing is reversed. And basically, the more sophisticated state of the universe that we're living in now, forget life on Earth, the physical universe, was the result of a simpler state, or in a way an inferior state. So the great diversity and complexity of the universe didn't come out of an even higher complexity, it actually came out of a simpler state. So the entire reasoning is suddenly reversed, and the theories start to develop that say, yes, just out of simple matter, more complex configurations of matter can emerge, one of them being the solar system emerging out of a cloud of gas. That was a big breakthrough as a theory. So you didn't need to imagine God creating the sun and the earth and all the planets. And this is an earth-shattering, universe-shattering idea, that the universe wasn't created by God, but that something like the solar system could have formed out of a cloud of gas. And it's the beginning now of an attempt to try and explain everything in the other way round. For that, from the simple comes the more complex, from the less differentiated comes the more differentiated. But yes, and that's just saying the same thing, only it's reminding me that that was one of the ideas for the proof of the existence of God. That former idea that in order for anything to appear here, something more perfect had to have been the cause of it. And if you just follow that reasoning back, you get back to there being an ultimate perfection, and that ultimate perfection is God. That was a kind of a... You know, the Middle Ages is famous for that kind of reasoning, which we came to reject, right? That reasoning by reasoning purely on the basis of concepts, right? We have a concept of perfection, and then we use that concept of perfection to reason that there must be an ultimate perfection. That perfection is God. It was an example of something that our modern age, I guess we would say, correctly rejected. Because we were just playing with concepts, playing with meanings, that you can't go from concepts and meanings and conclude from that how reality must be. This is part of what science has to say. To find out how reality is, you actually have to look at reality. You know, you have to investigate. Of course, the idea of reality, because we're philosophers, is itself problematic. So, and I think maybe we're covering a bit of ground twice here, but this is the whole Newtonian physics form of explanation hit, if you like, a wall with life. Yes, it was okay to start to explain the evolution of the universe, if you like, the evolution of how the planets were formed, how the sun was formed. We got a genetic explanation of that, but it hit a kind of a wall with how on earth do you explain? And we mentioned this last week. A tiny little sperm and a tiny little egg. How on earth could you explain the coming together of a tiny little sperm and a tiny little egg producing a body? Or the acorn producing a tree? You can't. You can't do it. There must be some kind of... even if there isn't a God, there has to be some kind of idea of the form of the body that's going to grow out of that, that in some sense or other is going to guide the way the body grows. There has to be, obviously, some kind of template. And this is Platonic. That template clearly doesn't exist physically, so it exists in some other dimension. Yes, in the dimension of mind, if you like. So there must be... there must be some kind of idea that is guiding the growth of all of these animal forms, including our own.
Potentialities.
Yes. Yeah. Do you see the sense of the... You wouldn't have... Living in that culture, you wouldn't have questioned that at all. Just like most people who are educated in theory of evolution don't question the theory of evolution, but because there's an obviousness in that, and the this whole area, morphology, is still questionable. It's not as if we've uncovered DNA, right, and we know how cells divide, but it's still questionable how it is that the entire division of the cells is orchestrated in such a way as to produce our body. Materialistic science keeps making advances in terms of being able to understand and explain that. So it's not a closed question, it's an open question. But certainly, to begin with, back in the 17th century, there was just nothing there to be able to explain how bodies develop. So it was obviously that there had to be some kind of guiding idea behind it, which Aristotle was already all over, right? The substantial form, he called them substantial forms. And Aristotle had an idea of the soul, which was not Christian. Which is the soul is the living form of the body, and it's as long as the body is alive, then the soul is the animating form of the body. So when you're born, it's the soul which has a substantial form that in effect you've inherited it in some sense from your parents. that is that living form is what you are. And when you die, the soul goes and the form disintegrates, and it's the soul that holds the form together, and this it's the energetic presence of the soul that is your living life. I'd just like you to see that this, you can't just to grasp that that is not an irrational or unreasonable idea. And if ever you've seen someone die, you might have a sense that something like that has just left the body. Or you might not. It all depends on how you're primed to see it. I know the first time that I saw somebody, a dead body, that was I had a strong impression. Well, something's gone. Something was there and it's gone. And you like an intuition of what Aristotle would have called your soul or your substantial form. Although Aristotle wasn't clear that the soul lived on. It could be that you die and that's the end. It's the soul just lives as long as...
We do feel a life force in our body, don't we? We feel an energy. And we have a sense of what our body is like. And I know somebody who had an amputation of their leg, but she still experiences her leg.
Yes.
I mean, I know why that is.
Yes.
But, I mean, it's still very difficult for her to kind of not experience herself in that kind of energetic way. And she says sometimes she looks down and she doesn't understand why there isn't a leg there. You
know? Yes.
So, she does after a second, but...
Yes, and we know, of course, there's a lot of work being done in neuroscience to try and explain that's a projection of the brain. It's a... You know, when you say you have expectations, we've talked about this phenomenologically.
Mm.
If you get a limb is I wanted to say amputed, but that's not a word. Yes, amputed. The neurological understanding is but all of the neurons in the brain are still predicting it's there. And in fact, that was if you want an actual visceral experience of what it means, how you're predicting your reality all the time, then the feeling of a phantom limb is giving it to you, you know, in spades. Although, the interesting thing is, but you don't see it, but you do feel it.
And they found that by putting a mirror so that it looks like you've got another leg there is actually quite comforting.
Yes. Well, I would imagine that if you have a prosthetic limb, then you start getting you can project feeling into it.
Yeah.
It's a bit like a car, you know, and I get that if I hit the curb. It's like, you know, I wince with the sense of I've already extended myself into the car.
Thinking there's one more step, and then you sort of, and then you feel the whole body going down and then coming back up. And then there's the old business of, what they call astral projection, where, you know, out-of-the-body experiences, where you actually feel that you're somewhere else, and then you turn around and you see yourself in bed, and you think, oh, bloody hell, what's this? And then the next minute you're back in your body. I mean, I've done that, and it's weird.
Yes. But, yes. And Thomas Metzinger, who's a German... cognitive scientist and philosopher who's strongly materialistic in his understanding, and he had a lot of out-of-body experiences as a teenager. So if you want to know how someone who's got a kind of a straightforward, more or less straightforward, somebody who's trying to square up out-of-body experiences, also he's meditated, you know, he's interested in Buddhism, mindfulness and all the rest of it, Thomas Metzinger. The human mind is fascinating. He's a kind of an opposite in some sense to me. Despite all of that, he thinks phenomenology was an utter waste of time. Yes, the ego tunnel. This is paperback, kind of fairly easy read. I hesitate to say easy read because I think Hans Jonas is a fairly easy read.
Oh, no.
So it's
oh my god.
I should give you some really really hard reading.
You,
try reading analytic philosophers in journal papers. You know, really technical philosophy is
drive needles into.
Well, there's a certain you have to have a certain amount of background before you can enjoy it. It's true, you know. And are you partly getting the background by doing this?
I think also reading is another skill. Reading philosophy.
Yes. Yeah, it's not. You're not reading a novel. You're not reading a novel. You're reading something that you're supposed to just take really slowly, and you have to read it when you're very awake. It's not a kind of It's not reading for pleasure in that way. It's but there's a pleasure to be got from it. But you have to work at it, and you need a lot of background. You know, you just can't just.
Yeah.
And getting the background is. It's just takes time.
And pay attention to words, right?
Yes.
Is this word? What does this word exactly mean?
But after a while, I mean, I find I can't really read anything else because I look at it and think, well, it's just candy floss, you know. Well, it's just saying nothing. Is it? There's nothing. There's no original idea here.
Mm.
What's it? What's this?
Yeah.
Then you end up having read most of the major philosophers, and there's nothing left for you to read, though. So that you end up just having to reread what you've already read. I'm a bit in that situation now. No. But Nicolette reads. John Steinbeck out loud to me, and I'm getting a lot from that. So, yeah. But I don't read fiction to myself. I think, well, what am I somehow or other, Nicolette reading it out, it becomes more like has a reality to me that it doesn't have if I read it to myself. That's odd then.
Yes,
I sure do.
The pals, Flophouse, we old Mac and the boys.
Yeah, we're right there in Cannery Row at the moment. We used to live in California,
yeah, we're on Sweet Thursday.
Yeah, Sweet Thursday.
Sometimes some people read a book and it doesn't have any kind of effect on their lives, on their thinking, on their. And some other people read some books and they change.
Yes.
Absolutely,
so, yeah. Well, it depends on the book and on where the person's at. The two match, ka-ching, you know, there's a shift in understanding. It's amazing what a book can do at the right time in your life, isn't it? Because often I've looked back on some books that really did a ka-ching for me in my 20s, and I look at them now and I think... But it's a matter of the right time as well, you know. It's like you don't know what it is you need to hear till you hear it, do you? But back to the problem of development, you see the whole Aristotelian view explained all this, and also there were the four causes in Aristotle that materialistic science is about to destroy that as well. Let's see if I can remember them. There's the formal cause, the final cause, the efficient cause, and the material cause. So everything in this Aristotelian science has. I mean, I was reading Heidegger on this. Actually, the proper translation from the Greek. is that everything is indebted to these things for its being. So this, let me. So yeah, the so the we're the so it's the there was a slightly different meaning to cause in Greek than our modern meaning. Our modern meanings become very pointed and narrow. But one of the causes of something's being what it is that there is a formal cause, that which is this substantial form, that things that we make, the formal cause is something in our minds. Right? The formal cause of a cup is the shape of the cup, in, if you like, is in the mind of the person who's producing it. But the formal cause of something in nature is that there's a pre-existing substantial form that is the formal cause of the eidos of the aspect that it comes to have in the world. It's shape, if you like. But there's more to it than shape, because of course the formal cause determines how you grow. So it's got a temporal side to it as well. And then the final cause is what's it for? What's its purpose? Everything has a purpose. And modern science has gone, psh! There's no formal cause, and there's no final cause. The efficient cause is all that really counts, and the efficient cause is what makes it. If I'm building some shelves at home at the moment, I'm the efficient cause of the shelves. And the material cause is what's it made of. So, you know, the material cause of my shelves is the wood. But we don't think that the wood caused the shelves anymore. What caused the shelves was me making them. Mm-hmm. Yes? And what ultimately materialistic science says is that what's the efficient cause is the laws of physics operating on matter. There's no formal cause. There's no other world of ideas or forms guiding the way things are going to occur. There's no end in mind. There's no purpose to the universe. It's not for the greater glory of God or for our salvation. Nothing like that. There's no final cause. The material isn't really a cause. It's just the inert, dead stuff upon which the laws of physics operate.
I think the world of form should be investigated, because the potentiality of the universe should be investigated as well. Because if you look at the planets around you, there aren't any complicated life forms. It's only on Earth, just the observable kind of planets and stuff.
Yes.
If the universe, this kind of has the potential of producing complicated life forms, what else can it produce?
Yes.
Like a scientist, if there's no Earth, a scientist will a scientist be able to predict that the universe has the potential of creating complicated life forms?
Well, I think for materialistic science, I think the better word is for rather than call it materialistic, it's rational mathematical science. I think yes, there's the idea there would be yes, we're as we get to understand more and more now the complex non-linear dynamics of the way things work here, it would be possible for us to start to think and develop other kinds of life forms, and science is going to try and do that. Of course, it's trying to reproduce synthetically reproduce living cells now. You know, there's a lot of work going on in that area, and if that succeeds, you can synthetically produce a living cell. Then you can start to engineer different kinds of life forms.
Like a living cell, the universe produced this living cell.
Yes.
What else can it produce that kind of challenges our
whole
mentality?
Yes, but it's short of going to other solar systems. I think it's going to be, science is going to see what it can do in terms of generating different kinds of, if you don't want to call them life forms, self-reproducing mechanisms.
John, can I just ask you something quite basic about all this? I mean, when you started off by saying that there was something deeply wrong with materialistic science and everything, I kind of thought we would be going down the path of the kind of, you know, the Mary Shelley view of, you know, if you start tampering with nature, if you have a science that's divorced from ethics,
yes,
you end up with nuclear weapons and genetically modified food and, you know, all kinds of horrors.
Yes.
But you're not saying that, are you? You're saying that the beliefs themselves, the actual ideas, rationality and scientific method and everything, there's something deeply wrong with that, not just with how science is applied.
I think wrong is the wrong way, that's the wrong word.
Has negative consequences.
Yes, wrong is it's binary thinking again, as if we reject it. It's not. I guess the approach here is to say no. We need to, in some sense, deeply understand what science is, and in doing that, in some sense or other, it will lose its hold on us. Whereas to reject it, it retains its hold. It just becomes a. It retains its hold as a negative power that you react against. Something that you fully seen through is no longer a negative power that you react against. You just see it for what it is.
But nobody's suggested. I mean, with the Mary Shelley thing, the kind of the Frankenstein's monster thing. I don't think anybody's suggesting that. The monster is science. The monster is misapplication of science.
Yes, yes. And I would, again, I guess my response to that is that's sort of where we are now. We're in our rationalistic science thinks that way. It thinks that I've been misapplied. The reason the planet's going to pot isn't to do with some materialistic science. And materialistic science, again, I'd like to say to do with rational science, rational mathematical science. It's not rational mathematical science's fault that the planet, all the problems the planet's facing. It's that we've misapplied it. And what the problem with the planet, this is a deep narrative in all of our power structures, is that we're not rational enough.
Ethical enough.
Well, no, we're extending our rationality to with climate change. You see, ethics can be understood rationally as well. It's irrational for the greater good of the human race. See that. The rational ethics, this isn't our area, anyway, I think it's Charlie's area, isn't it, for anyone who's done Charlie's course. I'm talking about the kind of debate that we have in our political world, which mentions ethics, but it really says what we're doing is irrational, because... It's going to have horrible economic consequences if we don't change the way we're behaving. It's going to have horrible political consequences. It's going to have unrest, famine, mass migration. Do you know, that's all... You could say it's ethical, but it's just what we're doing is irrational, unreasonable, because we're not... what rationality says is, do you see the consequences of what we're doing, where it's leading? It's irrational just to carry on. You need to be more rational. So we're going to fight climate change, not because we think nature's sacred or because we've had a basic change in our ontology or our approach. It's the same old approach, only it's found that it's fighting against what it considers to be irrationality in the human race. The irrationality of the human race being it's a kind of a irrational, short-sighted attachment to the way that it's living.
I think there's a very, very strong... If you're talking about the zeitgeist or what's the ethos in the culture, I think there's a very strong zeitgeist that says there is no more neutral science. I think that's been the big shift.
Yes.
I think people are now saying when you study something, when you research something, when you develop something, there are consequences. And there are consequences which are often very controversial that people do not necessarily agree on. And there are consequences that, you know, you cannot properly predict because you're looking too narrowly. And I don't think that's something that's being ignored. I think that's something that you hear a lot.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that that's still people being saying we're not being scientific enough.
Is it though? Is it? Really?
It's a criticism of a former set of attitudes and beliefs that were determining science.
Mm.
Yes? It's not a criticism of rationalistic science. It's a criticism of the way that it's been practiced.
Yes, and I think it's a criticism of the way science is divided up into tiny little areas, and there's no joined up thinking. You know, so if you're researching.
Yeah. So Maria, this is a big area, and the very course is about this.
Mm.
I'm aware of all of this, and I'm trying to say something about the deep structure of the rationality of our scientific thinking, the deep structure of it, deeper than that, and you're saying, oh no, we're challenging all of that, and I'm basically saying no, it's deeper than that, say something that Heidegger was trying to get across hasn't been heard yet, and it's quite fundamental, and it's to do with phenomenology. It's to do with the whole first part of the course, which we're not talking about directly, but it's to do with a basic shift at the very ground level of our ontological understanding of what's real.
Do the rest of you get this?
Well, by the way, when we say do we get the if it were a matter of just me saying here's the message,
yeah,
I wouldn't need to spend 20 weeks
no,
4
no,
hours
no,
of
no,
4
no.
hours do you know you think, well, just give it to me in a bite-sized piece, you know, there isn't a bite-sized piece here. I'm saying that let's look at the theory of evolution, how it works, and all of the mindset behind it, and let's hold over here how things were, as best as we can picture it, before, you know, what we threw away, for instance, the substantial forms. Because I think if you can just get a glimpse of how it would be to live in a society where something like the substantial forms were recognised as being real, what a different world that would be. Because you, in a way, I'm trying to reflect back to you the deep nature of the way that we think here, all of us. Not the level that you're discussing, where people are trying to reform science, is up there, and there's something beneath that. An unspoken, almost agreement about how we should proceed here, that has this. It's just come out of this past. It's not right or wrong. It's just come out of this past, and the task here is to try and illuminate this past in us. so that it doesn't determine us anymore. That's all really. But it's. I feel I need to get back to the details, and we've still got, you know, traditionally we do 2 hours, so I've still got 25 minutes before lunch. This whole slide was just about the fact that we lived with the obviousness that everything had a purpose, and there were a sort of formal cause for everything. And what I want to throw on the table is, what if that's true? We don't know that's not true. It hasn't been rejected because it was proven false. Do you think the alternative explanation here, the explanation of science, which theory of evolution is about to bring into bear, which is deeply accepted in our culture, is that the whole thing was just a series of accidents? Now, nothing about us being here was in any way, there was no intention and no intelligence behind it. The entire thing, we have all of this material. Right, there was one miracle. The miracle was the material arrives, and the laws of how it behaves arrive. They arrive in ching, one miracle, but then after that, the entire thing. There's no intentionality, intelligence, or anything behind it. It's like just a giant, extraordinarily complex piece of machinery that happened to produce us. And we'll get rid of us just as accidentally, in a way. with our sort of brains that we've got, we look for reasons in things, and we look for purpose in things, but that's entirely a result of the accident of the brains that have evolved in us. That's the view.
We need an accident to stop climate change and mass migration. We need an accident.
Well, no. If climate change is averted, it'll be to do with the structure of the brains that have evolved in us, and also how the environment is interacting with those brains. But it's just like some kind of extraordinarily enormous computer algorithm that whose interactions are so complex that nobody could possibly predict what's going to happen. But what's going to happen isn't the result of anybody making any kind of decision, because the whole idea of you making a decision in that world is a sort of an illusory thing, that it's just kind of a sport just thrown up by the neurons.
No, I'm not with that. But I don't see the need for a creator, like a god.
No, but you're still thinking about, I'm comfortable with that, I agree with it, I disagree with it. I'm just saying it's not to be agreed with or disagree with. This is just you don't have to feel comfortable or uncomfortable with it. It's just a story.
No.
The gist of it is it's a story. It's a particular kind of story about our origins, like Genesis was in the Bible.
I think it's believable, if that's what you're
asking. Well, it's too early to say if it's believable or not. In terms of where we are in the course, it's just we're coming to terms with what the story is, what it says, what it's
right.
what are the consequences of the story, and where did it come from?
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Because we tend to we do believe in this story. It's not just a story for us and for people who are embedded in the scientific culture. It's more than a story. It's the most believable story. It's not just a story. It's the most believable. It's I guess the thinking is, it's the most rational. It's the most rational explanation we have.
I don't think its rationality is what appeals to me.
No.
I think I've got completely irrational reasons for believing in this.
Yeah. Well, that's all coming in here. So. We're going into a little bit of detail what theory of evolution has to say, but I think we're clear with a kind of a pop culture idea of evolution that in a way it got rid of the need for all of that stuff, the formal cause, the teleology, that's the final cause, and for being some kind of creator god who has to make all the species and everything work and happen here. It's in terms of simplifying things. It just cut the ground under the need for all of that.
I can see this every day in social life, people using this kind of evolution and science to suppress other people and kind of shut them up or kind of marginalize their worries or their convictions.
Yes.
It's a kind of manipulative social tactic.
Yes, because everything that you think and believe and hold to be true or sacred or etc. On this view is an illusion. Of course, we'll respect people's illusions because if you try and shatter people's illusions, it has unpleasant consequences. So we treat people's illusions as a sort of a kind of a reality to them, because if somebody's passionately attached to an illusion, then that determines how they behave. But the essential view from the theory of evolution is that there isn't anything that our whole view of our lives is false. Except for those few lucky individuals who fully understand the theory of evolution, of which there are very few. Yeah, Daniel Dennett's probably. I like to bring him. He's one of the few people that's actually thought it through and is consistent with it. And generally, people who've done that are pretty proud. Pretty proud that there's a sort of I'm man or woman enough to face it. It's bleak, but it's the way it is. There's a kind of a courageous facing the bleakness and the and often people have a sense of, and it's just so amazing that all of this could have happened purely by, if you like, chance. The whole thing in itself, I think Dennett and Dawkins and the people who are passionately attached to this actually, again in a Jungian way, have a kind of a religious awe in their subconscious about how incredible it is that such a world could have been produced out of these basically simple principles. There's an awe in them about it. I encountered this myself meeting Marvin Minsky, who was one of the founders of artificial intelligence, and I was a mere boy when I met him virtually, and I said, "Surely, you see, you don't think all of this is just the result of, you know, material interactions. And he just sort of shot me down in flames. He said it isn't just. It isn't a just. The whole thing's absolutely amazing. What matter has done. You know, it's not a just, it's not a mere thing. You know, he started a tirade against me, and I just kind of, in a way, I'm the response to that. That he's so destroyed me that I feel I've spent a large part of my life developing a response. You know, because I realised at that time I had no intelligent response to his triumphant materialism. Because a lot of these people in these key positions in the world, they're forces to be reckoned with. They're not just, you know, they're significant and very intelligent people, and they have thought things through to a level that most people have just, you know, don't bother at all. I still wouldn't like to have a debate with Marvin, but he's dead. He's died now. He was a figure along the lines of Dennett, and I don't think Richard Dawkins is so impressive, but Daniel Dennett is. Generally, it's the Americans who can really deliver this kind of stuff. You know, it's part of the American culture. I think is sort of suited to this. Anyway, so the thing that happened, I mean, the crucial thing that the theory of evolution inaugurated was that final bastion that says, well, materialistic science can't explain life. Evolution does explain how things, bodies like us, could have emerged without there being any of the need for this medieval, Aristotelian, Christian mumbo-jumbo about there being some other world with substantial forms in it and some creator god. The theory of evolution said no. The entire, what we observe and what we measure, including the bodies of the animals and the plants, can all be explained in terms of these material, mathematical principles. You don't need any other agency anymore to explain it. Now, at this point, you've still got, and we still have today, except for the undeniable fact of our subjectivities, that we are conscious, that we are having experiences. That's left out of the equation, because that's not part of what science can measure. It's not part of the res extensa. But in terms of the res extensa, the theory of evolution basically came. Materialistic science claimed a victory. It didn't. It was waiting. That was like step one of the battle. I mean, it took a long time before. 1953, was it? Crick and Watson finally unravelled the structure of DNA. Because the part of the theory of evolution is that inheritance is in some sense physical. You physically inherit the traits of your parents. How is that done? It must be done in some way or other. It's not until the early 1950s that that a candidate molecule, namely DNA, is discovered that could in some sense explain how that hereditary information is passed on. So there was still in biology in the 1930s vehement debate amongst the mechanists and the vitalists. So vitalism still hung on to the idea that no, you can't explain life this way. But to a certain extent, it was the mere discovery of DNA that caused the debate to be shut down, and for basically to be described as a vitalist then became a kind of an insult. Previously it was a more respectable position, but not that the discovery of DNA disproved vitalism. It's more, you know, like if you study how science evolves, it's a society of people like anything else. And it was more like the discovery of DNA just was such a remarkable scientific achievement that there was a shift in the attitudes of people doing biology towards the fact that this research agenda that's looked into mechanism has delivered. It's delivered something amazing, and what we need to work on now is studying DNA and molecular biology. And so all of biology started to focus on an area which is likely to deliver results, and vitalism just faded away. So that it's not as if Darwin produced the Origin of Species and bingo, the argument was finished, but you could say that the final nail in the coffin of some credible alternative was hammered in with the discovery of DNA. And we, the people that we are, have certainly inherited that. You know, we weren't part of the 1930s, which in a way was intellectually a much more vibrant time between the wars than we've sort of been in a kind of a monoculture somewhat since then.
Do you not think that Darwinism and the theory of evolution would be a positive force on respecting nature? Because it's
coming soon, coming in the next slide.
Oh.
Yes. So yes, I feel Maria, you're looking at the scales and you're thinking I'm coming down on something here. I'm coming down on something because I'm assuming that you know all the pluses, because our culture I don't feel I have to, but you're right. The theory of evolution is a remarkable intellectual achievement. And it's explained a tremendous amount, and it does. The fact that the species have evolved is a fact. Unless you really want to start to develop extreme views, I think it's reasonable to accept that it's a fact, not that God created all the fossils and all the rest of it. Although I do find there's even an interesting way to save the biblical story, and that is that all of life on Earth only really appeared when the human race became conscious, and that could then fit into some kind of creation at a fixed, fairly reasonably short time ago, not 3003 BC or whenever they tried to make it up, but certainly a point a few thousand years BC, you could say there was a point there where the human race started to become self-conscious and distinguish itself from a certain animal consciousness, and you could say at that point in time a certain kind of creation did happen, the self-conscious recognition of the earth and all the species. But that's not, unfortunately, a more intelligent Christianity could have. Yeah, they missed that one, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But there. You'd still have to argue about this, the extrusion of teleology, right? Teleology is the idea that there's an end or a purpose, and one of the clear tenets of neo-Darwinism, as it's now called, is that it was the blind watchmaker. Do you remember that was a Richard Dawkins book called The Blind Watchmaker? As in, evolution is blind. It doesn't have any it doesn't have any view. I'm going to create this marvelous thing called the human being. I've got to start with the cell, but I've got something in mind there, and I'm going to start. It's going to take me a long, long time, but I'm going to slowly assemble something like a human being, because what the earth needs is a self-conscious being, able to experience the earth. And I've got all of that. All of that's in me. I'm this creative intelligence behind all of life. That's the kind of thing you can't go into a biology department and say there's a creative intelligence behind all of this. That's definitely not what Darwinism has to say. It's the opposite, right? It's saying that's not needed, not necessary. It's all happened according to this other again, people get passionate about it. This other extraordinary principle that it's all in potential in matter with no plan whatsoever. It's this amazing. But there's something. There is something. Even if that's true, it's still pretty amazing, right? That it's produced us. Whatever way you look at it, it's got the feeling of a miracle in it.
A consciousness is a plus, isn't it? You can survive in your environment far better.
But consciousness is not the same as a brain that is able to reflect. See, we can... we have a certain experience when our brain... A brain reflecting means that that one process in the brain is able to, if you like, inspect another process in the brain. You could say what the human brain probably, this is still speculation, probably achieved was it grew a neocortex big enough that it was possible for one part of the neocortex to look at another part. Now that's what we call being self-conscious. But doesn't have to be any experience associated with that. You could build a machine where one process is able to look at another process. Of course, it wouldn't be looking. It would just be computing, but using computing about another process going on within itself that itself was connected to the world. So what I'm saying is that just because we're self-conscious doesn't mean we're not mechanical. And that there isn't a mechanical reflection of our experience of self-consciousness going on in the brain.
Well, it's useful, whatever it is, though.
Oh yeah, yeah. That ability to do that. it means that we can imagine futures,
yeah.
And it gives us a reach that means that we can reach out in time, far beyond the abilities of the animals around us. Which means that we came to predominate on the planet. But see, neo-Darwinism is super happy with that. By accident, we started to... The neocortex in the human brain started to swell and swell and swell. You know, we started to swell up until we reached the capacity of the female hips. And basically, we try to stuff as big a head as we can out of there, right? Why? Because nature's by accident... It found that the bigger the head, the further the view into the future, because we managed by accident to be able to assemble neocortexes that can predict, and as soon as you can predict, you start to reproduce better. So the bigger the neocortex, the more you can predict, the more you reproduce. Bingo, human race. No plan whatsoever. Just accidentally bumped into brains that could predict.
I hear a lot of intelligent, even educated people, a lot of people, they go like, oh, the purpose of life is to pass the genes.
Yes, but that's if they're proper neo-Darwinists, that's not a purpose.
Exactly.
Because that's just what happens.
Yeah.
Right?
You genuinely believe that.
Yes, that is, and there's an entire, there's a large group of people are committed to explaining everything about human behaviour in terms of what's come out of evolution, and doing a pretty good job, I have to say, explaining all of our behaviours products of evolution, and then different kinds of mechanisms have operated in human culture. You know, it's stopped being survival of the fittest now, but we can still trace all of it back to this genesis of the first self-reproducing cellular automata in the ocean. You know, everything else just... That's what science... But can I just remind you, do you see that the birth of that way of thinking was already in Newton and Galileo? They were already looking for physical, mathematical explanations that could generate... This is what if we pass right back. Remember, what science is looking for is the axioms out of which we can generate the rest, the entire universe, by deduction. Yes, and one of the blockages was you can't do that for living bodies. And Darwin says, basically, yes, you can. Here's how you can do it. And when that falls, I think that, and then pretty soon after the First World War, in some sense or other, caused the idea of a creator God to collapse in European civilization as the guiding myth by which people live. I mean, to begin with, I think before the First World War, you just had the educated elite, you know, who were aware of this, and the philosophers and the thinkers were, the evolution had seeped into their world in a deep way, and transformed their understanding. But the First World War, the catastrophe of the First World War, shattered that idea of, and the Second World War, of course, that there could be some kind of benevolent creator God, a la the Christian view, that there was something flawed with that view, and in the absence of that, in that being shattered in such a violent way, what was there to catch? What was there underneath it? You know, and in our culture, what was underneath it was our science, our scientific understanding. That was the net, if you like, that caught people with the shattering of faith, the shattering of a worldview, which, you know, a worldview is shattered from many directions, of course. And for Maria, it was shattered quite in your teenage life, wasn't it?
Mm.
You know, it's not that Christian worldview is gone. It lives on for many people, but the kind of, as a culture, it no longer holds centre stage anymore. You know, it's a minority pursuit in a way.
Yeah, it was easier to lose your faith in the 1950s than it would have been 100 years before.
Yes.
Because having lost my faith, I could then find lots of other people who, like me, didn't have a faith.
Yes.
Whereas before, I would have been completely isolated or treated as mad.
Yes. Yes. Yes, and I think the utter... irrationality and horror of what happened in Europe with the Nazis just ended this idea that of there being a European Christian civilization. It's good. Christian. You know, it should have ended with the Spanish Inquisition, but you know, things. Like Dr. Hitchens said, it takes a long time for something to die, it usually dies in this way, that it's unable to accommodate something that actually happens. It doesn't have the resource you know, to say, to give an account of what happened, what just happened in the Second World War.
I got a real sense when I went to Sicily and I went to Syracuse, where there's a church there which is very ancient, and where the apostles came to. A couple of them actually came there. And it's a very, very old place, and it's got some paintings on the wall of the apostles, you know, very, very early stuff. And they said that it was a place where, you know, the early Christians came to worship, so that while they were still kind of considered to be a radical group, and
yes,
probably under some danger as well.
Yes.
And a lot of the faces that were painted on the wall, so a lot of them were women as well, because it was a religion that was very attractive early on. Christianity was very attractive to women before it got taken up by Rome. So. And I got a real sense of how different it was. It was so massively different to what you experience in St. Peter's in Rome, which is revolting. It's like, yes, we're the Vatican, we're powerful, we're rich, we're stronger than you, we're dominant, you know, and it was, hated St. Peter's. But this place was lovely. And I thought, oh, yeah, this originally was the religion of the ordinary people,
yes,
of the oppressed, of the people without power. And
yes,
I kind of reconnected to it a little bit.
Yes.
And I thought this religion, this original Christianity, would not have allowed horrors that happened afterwards. There would have not, if that had remained like that, there wouldn't have been an Inquisition.
Yes. Yes, there is
because
that.
Because they were oppressed.
Yeah.
Right. There is in Muhammad's story, Muhammad goes to Sudan and he meets the Christian king of Sudan and he starts saying poetry of praise to, and most of what he said in early, before he became like military leader, before he conquered anything. In the beginning it was all about love and being sympathetic and compassionate, but after he conquered the Arabian some cities, he started writing this verse, kill,
and he was,
punish
he was,
the
he was
people who feed
very
you.
Influenced by his wife.
Yeah.
She was the driving force.
I mean, if they didn't crucify Jesus, if Jesus became like very kind of popular and people are following him and he became like very powerful, politically influential, would he have said if the Romans attacked, flee to the mountains? Or he would have said, well, fight them back, or like kill the Romans, or he died young.
Yes.
But Muhammad lived on until he died in his 60s.
Yes. Yes, well, impossible to say, isn't it? Jesus the man.
He said an eye
yes.
for an eye, though.
No, that was the Old Testament, wasn't it? Yeah. No, turn the other cheek. Jesus is turn the other cheek.
He was just a carpenter. He's going to say, I'll turn the other cheek. But if he was a military leader, powerful military leader, would he have said?
But the Christianity in its early genesis was a remarkable and revolutionary force. In that Roman world, barbaric Roman world, and you could feel that. I have a sense that if we were beamed back there, because of the kind of people we are, we'd be very attracted to it.
Yeah, it was the religion for women and slaves, basically.
Yeah,
it was
but it was absolutely. What was extraordinary about it was its universality. It wasn't a little tribal thing anymore. It was universal love, the gospel of universal love. I mean that's been so drummed into us over the years because it's become dead. But at the time, it would have been something extraordinary. So the Romans were included, right? The Romans the Gentiles and the Jews, the Arabs, anyone. It wasn't a local racial or tribal.
Mm.
You know, it was and the message was an extraordinary message for those times.
Mm.
You know, when people were just, you know, they were just sitting there in the Colosseum saying, "Yeah, kill him, kill him, kill him." You know, and slaves being, you know, having utter power over people. No sense that there was any kind of that in some sense that there was an eternal soul in every individual. You know, that was just a, and that we're all equal in God's eyes. I mean, these are tremendous, shocking, you know, beautiful messages, and we're still in a way, you know, they still under the surface of our culture. Do you know, we have a sense, our sense of morality really is informed by that. Somewhere or other, we kind of know what's right and what's wrong. We know there's a sense of it, but if you look back into it, there's a sense of, well, that, I don't think the Romans thought that way.
Mm.
Do you know, they... And
a lot of untouchables in India, after being Christianized, they were, now it's, they value this kind of sympathy to the untouchables after the Christians arrived in India.
Mm.
But before that, they wouldn't touch an untouchable. They wouldn't get even closer to this kind of oppressed,
yes,
minority in India.
And I'm reminded now of a friend of mine who's, you know, because I'm kind of fashionably critical of our culture, and he's whenever I start being critical of the culture, he starts to rise up and says, there's no other culture on earth ever that even considered making women equal. The fact that maybe it hasn't occurred, but even considered it, you know, and this comes out of Christianity really, and that there should be free speech, which is a kind of a recognition that everybody has an equal right to speak. No other culture even dreamt of such a thing. You know, these are all extraordinary. You know, the Greeks. The Greeks were slave-owning pagans. So, yeah, that's right. They were so misogynistic. They preferred young boys to their, you know, I think the boys, you know, the academy just treated the women as to look after their home and bear children.
It was normal in the Ottoman Empire until 1915. It was normal for anybody to have boys, use them like harem houses.
I mean, let's not dwell on it all, but basically, you see, Christianity has had this tremendous civilizing effect, and it's still, if you just cast your eye over the world, yeah, I think I'd rather live in Western Europe, or you know, one of the kind of offshoots of that, like Australia or Canada, New Zealand, maybe America, but you know. But add to living, you know, actually day by day, and it's still, it's not, that's what I mean. It's not all negative. You can't just kind of carve off Christianity and say, and we got rid of that. Now, and the same thing here, it sounds sometimes like I'm about to carve off science and say, well, let's get rid of that. It's not that, definitely not that, right? It's for me, it's all about, we have to be able to assimilate science now into the situation in which we find ourselves now. Science was a response to medievalism. Yeah, new world. But we don't want to throw it out and become, you know, some kind of throwback to that. You know, because there's a certain to reject science would be to embrace a certain irrationalism that is lying beneath the surface. I think you could say Trump is an expression of that. It's time for lunch, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.